You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF. Please join me in welcoming author and entrepreneur Eric Ries and moderator Todd Park.
Supposed to go over here.
All right. Hello, and welcome to tonight's Inforum program at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Todd Park, and I'm incredibly excited to be here speaking with Eric Ries, entrepreneur, legendary author of The Lean Startup, which spawned an entire movement, and who's just come out with his latest book, The Startup Way, which we'll be talking about tonight. So let's get going. Eric, you've been a founder since college. You're a serial entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about how your journey as an entrepreneur got started.
Well, first of all, thank you, everybody, for being here, and thank you, Todd, for doing this with me. Todd is an American hero, so I'm very honored to share the stage with you. Thank you. And I love the new space, Commonwealth Club. This is incredible compared to the last time I was here. So very impressive. I was not one of those kids that dreamed about being an entrepreneur, or really even dreaming to be in business in any way. I was a kid, you know, in my parents' basement programming computers, just like the stereotype, that was me. And I couldn't believe when I found out that you could get paid for programming. I had no idea. I was like one of the great days of my childhood to find that out. I would have been happy to pay for the privilege to do it, and then people were going to pay me. It was like too good to be true. And it's only because I think I was in college during the dot-com bubble that, you know, everyone was starting a startup, and it was the hot thing to do. And in fact, if you've seen the movie The Social Network, I had the complete first half of the movie experience, where we, you know, me and my too smart to, for, you know, their own good friends built this awesome product. Our product idea, by the way, was that top college students from top universities should create online profiles for the purpose of sharing. Which, you know, that did turn out to be a pretty good idea, but we were a little off. We wanted them to do that for recruiting purposes to get a job, so just slightly missed. And so we never had the second half of the movie experience where, you know, we made a lot of money and got around to suing each other and the whatnot. So that was my entree into entrepreneurship, and it was both humiliating because I was a total failure, but also really addictive in a certain way. And the idea that you could have that kind of impact, you know, directly, at the time I was thinking mostly through technology, that was, even though it didn't work out, a pretty amazing experience.
I always remember the first time we met. It was at South by Southwest.
Yeah.
And Tim O'Reilly got us together. And you sat down and explained Lean Startup to me. And I literally had the experience of someone telling me all the things I'd learned the hard way over the last 10 years as an entrepreneur by x-raying every broken bone in my body. And I told you, like, I wish I'd met you 10 years ago, right? Because it would save me a huge amount of heartbreak. So how did you come to distill, right, what's now become this legendary ethos of how you systematically build great startups?
Well, I don't take credit for it myself. And I, you know, the Lean Startup builds on so many pre-existing theories that are super important. Agile development and, of course, lean manufacturing, where it gets its name. Customer development and DevOps and design thinking. And it was just with a group of veterans who are veteran entrepreneurs from the military and John Boyd and the OODA loop. And so, you know, I, for whatever reason, when I was an entrepreneur, I really wanted to do things a certain way. I just had a certain intuition. I was always the person pushing for us to do things in a more customer-centric way, get customers involved in product development way too early, release the product too soon, release it too frequently. And I had this intuition. And when I finally got to become, you know, the technical co-founder of startups where people had to work for me and do it my way, you know, they would do it because I said we had to, but I was constantly being asked the question, why does that work? And I didn't really know why it worked. It just seemed obvious to me that it should work. And for a long time, I just figured I would just show people the evidence that it did work, and that would be enough for them to abandon the methods and practices that they had, you know, used in their entire career and had driven a lot of professional success based on evidence. And does that really sound like human beings to you? Not really. That was almost 0% success rate of converting anybody to my way of working by showing them the evidence that it worked. That nobody wanted to hear about the evidence that it worked. They wanted to know why. Tell me a story about why it worked. And I was, you know, really interested in that question. It took me a long time to try to figure out, like, just get some kind of theoretical handle on why does it? I could see that it worked, but why? And that's where ideas like lean manufacturing, you know, where we borrowed the idea from Lean Startup to look at the batch size of work and cycle time, but apply them in a new domain, the innovation domain, that's not just about manufacturing efficiency, not just about building the product we already know how to build, but better.
Yeah.
But answering this question of, like, what should we even be doing in the first place?
So to this day, Lean Startup is the only book. Now there's two books, Startup book, that I basically tell everyone on all my teams to read.
Thank you.
But for those of you in the audience who have not read it yet, and you should, can you just do literally Lean Startup, the philosophy of it, right, in 2 minutes?
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, pithy is not really my thing. That's why these books are more than 10 pages long. I'll do my best. So in the Lean Startup, I offered a definition of what is a startup in the first place. And I called
it
a human institution designed to create something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty. So it doesn't matter what industry, sector, what says on your business card. If you don't know what you're doing, then you are an entrepreneur, whether you admit it or not. So since we don't know what's going to happen in the future, which, by the way, in other domains is not considered a controversial statement, but in business, we still have this idea that you're going to, like, make the future happen through your mind or whatever, which normally we would call astrology, not be like the Silicon Valley way. We usually more on the science. So if we don't know what's going to happen in the future, the radical breakthrough idea is, like, maybe we should use science to try to find out by breaking down our business plan into a set of hypotheses called leap of faith assumptions, what has to be true in order for this to be a good idea. Then let's go test those things scientifically, but not, this is not an academic exercise to find out, like, you know, eventually by the time we're all dead, whether it's a good idea. It's a business exercise, an impact exercise, so let's find out quickly. So as soon as possible, build what we call a minimum viable product, or MVP, an experiment designed to reveal whether or not our assumptions are true or false. And then, and this was the most controversial part of it in the early days, if the strategy's not working, instead of either giving up or persevering the plane into the ground through stubbornness, let's pivot. A change in strategy without a change in vision. So although we do this rapid experimentation and iteration in the short term, it only makes sense to do that, just like with a scientific theory, if we are committed over the long term to some vision that we think is worth all the pain and humiliation of being an entrepreneur. Was that 2 minutes? Did I do good?
It's awesome. Yeah, absolutely. So you write this into the book, right? Lean Startup. It gets published.
Yeah.
Right? And then, boom, right? It becomes a movement, right? So did you anticipate that?
Like, oh, my God.
What were you expecting? What did it feel like when it started spreading like wildfire?
Just to give you a sense of how much I didn't expect it, one of the very early times I gave a talk about Lean Startup, I was just, you know, it was even before the book had come out, and I was at a big, big technology conference, and I was trying to get into the room where I was supposed to give the talk, and I physically couldn't get in the room. And I was talking to a friend of mine. I was like, this is so rude of the previous speaker to keep be going on so much that they haven't cleared the room to let people, like, people, at least people, get out of the room so that my audience can come in to hear me speak. And my friend's like, you don't understand. You physically can't get in there. These people are here for you. And I was like, why? I was like, that's not the plan. I was not in any way geared up for that. And you know, and those early experiences of, like, people just showing up, it was very overwhelming. Like, I'm an introverted engineer by training. This is not, when I started programming computers in my parents' basement, this is not the plan. One day I would get to do these amazing things, like to be with all of you today. So it took me a while to comprehend what was happening and to adjust to it. And then when people started to turn it into a movement, like, when people use that word in business, it's a little bit hokey, so I was like, is that really the right word? But, like, there's hundreds of local Lean Startup meetup groups all over the world.
How did that start?
I'll tell you exactly how it started. There was a San Francisco entrepreneur. His name was Rich Collins. He called me one day and he said, I'd like your permission to start the San Francisco Lean Startup meetup group where we're going to get together and talk about Lean Startup. And I said, well, first of all, you don't need my permission, but that sounds like a terrible idea. And I don't recommend that you do that. I was like, no one's going to come to the meetup. That's going to be totally lame and you're going to be disappointed and then it's going to be my fault. So, you know, please don't do this. And he said, well, if anybody comes, will you come speak to the first meetup? And I was like, that seemed like the easiest promise to make ever. I was like, well, no one's going to come, so sure. Yeah, of course, I'd be happy to come. And of course, you know, I mean, it's funny now, but like a lot of people came. And a lot of people were in Silicon Valley, you know, from other places, heard about it, and they said, well, why don't we have one of those in my city? And it just, you know, just completely spread organically. I never told anybody it was a good idea. I didn't really even understand it for a long time. That time that we met at South by Southwest, that was a few years in already, and we had a meetup of meetup group organizers at South by Southwest, of which there were like 50 people at the meetup. And everyone's talking about how, like, in Toronto, they do lean coffee, where they get together once a week and they do it over coffee. And, like, in Texas, they do it over barbecue. It was like, you know, everyone had their kind of different spin on it, different. And as the craziness and the media and the hype around these startups started to grow and get, you know, from my point of view, totally out of control, the thing that I would always go back to is I'd be like, okay, I'm getting all this fame and adulation for this. But the real, actual, honest-to-God work of advancing these ideas and converting thousands of people this way of thinking are being done in these meetup groups where no one's getting on TV for being there. No one's being paid to be there. No one's getting any kind of fame. Or they're just there because they really believe entrepreneurship has the power to change the world, and they want to get better at it. And I guess the idea of improving entrepreneurial practice systematically was a new idea.
And this is a
grateful to have been part of it.
This is a great segue into now the startup way.
Yeah,
where you're now articulating the idea, right, that the startup way, right, and how you build great startups isn't just for building a new .communist startup in Silicon Valley, right, but it really applies to any human institution that's seeking to do something new in an environment of high uncertainty, right?
Yeah, exactly. And
including in big organizations, right? So talk about that journey. Like, how did that realization begin to dawn upon you? Like, what happened between Lean Startup and the startup?
Sure. So I had made those bold claims in the Lean Startup that this could be applied to, you know, by anyone to any kind of organization, subject to some provision. And I didn't really know if that was true or not at the time. It was a deductive consequence of the theory. So I was like, hey, this sounds pretty interesting. Seems like it should work and all. And I've laid out some examples of how it might work. And then right from the start of the book being published, people would come up to me and say, well, I accept your challenge. And I would say, what challenge? Well, you said this can. Well, I'm a general manager in a big company. You said this could work for me, so you know, let's go. And at first time, a couple times it happened, I was like, well, best of luck. that's not really my department. But you're like, you're on the wrong floor of the store. I don't. That's not what I know. I know about Star. They said, no, I got that covered. Did you hear me? I'm a general manager. I can handle the politics. I can handle the organizational structure. A lot of these people had read Clay Christensen's Innovator's Dilemma, Innovator's Solution. So they had gotten budget for an independent project team that was separate from corporate. They followed all these best practices about fostering corporate innovation. And they would be like, so I did all that, but what is my team supposed to actually do every day? We come into work. I got them the beanbag chairs. I got the foosball table. We're apart from corporate. We're wearing jeans. Like, we're doing all the things. But we're still doing, like, a business plan and a waterfall development. And we've been at this for 9 months, and we haven't shipped anything to customers yet. And that doesn't feel very innovative. But my team says that's the only way that you can work in a rigorous way. And so it took a while for me. I was very slow on the uptake to realize that this was actually a very interesting problem. And what got me, like, so I was getting asked to do this big company stuff. And, of course, obviously, you know, we got to know each other and started to do this kind of stuff in like true government bureaucracy. Like, people was like, my organization is too bureaucratic and political to do this. And I'm like, compared to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, like, no offense, but like, it's more political than Obamacare. Like, I'm going to say no to that one. Like, right? So we started to have that experience. And then at the same time all that was happening, a bunch of startups that were like really early adopters of Lean Startup, you know, we forget, we talk about startups like they're small businesses, but not by design. We don't want to be small businesses. We're trying to avoid that fate. And so some of those folks actually got to product market fit and started to scale, and some of them have real exponential growth. And a lot of those founders started calling me up and saying, hey, remember when you were talking about Lean Startup, you know, in those early days? I remember the part about minimum viable product. That makes a great bumper sticker. And I got the T-shirt that says Pivot on it. I got that. But wasn't there also something about management, something or other? I'm like, oh, yes, you mean the system of entrepreneurial management powered by innovation accounting? They're like, yeah, that thing. Could we talk about that now? I wasn't paying attention then, but could we talk about that? Because a lot of these founders have this experience where all of a sudden you have 1,000 employees, 5,000 employees, 10,000 employees, and the people that work for you are not behaving in the entrepreneurial way that you did when you started the company, and it starts to drive you crazy. And a few of those CEOs would even confess to me privately, listen, I'm not sure I could even get a job at this company if I wasn't already the CEO. And I'm not even really sure I would want to work at this company. I mean, being the founder CEO is a great gig, don't get me wrong. But like, if I was an entry-level employee, I this place is already too bureaucratic for me. I'd be fired in a heartbeat. And I started this company because I hate big companies. So why did that happen to me? And like, where did our startup DNA go? And the, like, this is like mysterious force that would settle in. And so I was leading this very strange double life where sometimes even on the very same day, I would meet with like the CEO of Fortune 100 company. And in the afternoon, I'd be meeting with the CEO of like a unicorn startup. And the thing that no one ever believes is we would be having the same conversation about how do we get this problem, to get our internal entrepreneurs to act like it, and how do we get our internal startups to thrive. And eventually, I had this, you know, realization that the reason we're having the same conversation is we've built to the same blueprint. These companies, this one company's 5 years old, this company's 100 years old, but let me take a little x-ray of their org chart, and let me reanimate the ghost of Alfred Sloan and show him this org chart, and he would say, oh yeah, that's like the one I put together for GM in the 20s. I know that. And you guys have made a few refinements around the edges, but it's the same basic system. And I was like, that doesn't seem right. Like, why are we recreating this old-fashioned way of building when, like, we treat everything else about companies as new and different and dynamic, and, like, disruptive technologies meant all this other stuff. So I was like, right, we're not, we haven't updated the blueprint. So let's do that. And it doesn't matter what size the company is. Like, if you, same blueprint, same behavior. So same incentive design, same HR policies, same the way we do budgeting and resource allocation. Then just necessarily we're going to get these same behaviors. And so starting to develop a new body of work around what does a modern company really look like and what should that new blueprint be, that kind of became my new work.
Yeah, and the book is fantastic and lays this out incredibly well. And as you know, like when I was in the U.S. government, right, we very much employed what you talk about in Lean Startup and Startup Way, on rescuing healthcare.gov, on founding
thank the you US, for that, by the way.
Founding the U.S. Digital Service that then replicated the rescue and services to serve veterans and immigrants, et cetera.
Yeah.
And you tell many really engrossing stories in the book about large organizations and organizations that have become large, right, yeah, traveling on this journey. And the one that I found myself really getting enamored by is, yeah, GE.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, they just seem to have taken it like to a level that I found incredible.
That's saying a lot coming from you, who's you guys will never know the depths of reform that Todd had to drive in the federal government.
Well, I actually want to tell my compatriots in the U.S. Gov who are still there, right?
Yeah.
Still cranking with this, to just read the book and study what GE is doing. Go travel to GE because they're really taking it to a level that I think is really inspiring. So
they only do things big. That's really their only way. So yeah, they
and they started small, like as per like your
that's
point.
Exactly right.
And I thought the Series X story.
Oh sure, yeah.
Which is where the whole ball started rolling, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell that story?
Oh yeah, sure. So the Series X engine was a diesel reciprocating platform. None of you know what that is. It's okay. I didn't know what it was either. I kept using the word engine and turbine interchangeably in my early interactions with GE, which is not okay, by the way. Those are not two totally different things. Operate by completely different physical principles, so it really pissed them off. I didn't know anything about what this is. So this is a piece of physical equipment. It's not like a software app. It's not, you know, this is not a Silicon Valley thing. It's a piece of physical equipment. It's huge. It's used for fracking. It's used for stationary drilling. It's used for mobile, what they call marine electric in boats. It's used for locomotive. Like, when I was meeting this team for the first time, I was like, okay, so like in a boat, on a train, by a sea, in a plane, like, you know, it was like Dr. Seuss to me. What is this thing? And it's complicated. The original plan to build this when I met them was they were going to spend 5 years, and if I remember right, something like $300 million to develop this new thing and launch it worldwide. It was going to be amazing. And so I had been working with a couple of the senior officers at GE, Beth Comstock, who was the CMO at the time, Jamie Miller, who's now the new CFO, and a couple others. And they had convinced the then CEO, Jeff Immelt, that we should do something around this. They were really interested in simplification and innovation and how do we drive it. And Jeff had the really brilliant idea. He's like, all right, well, let's do a pilot program. That's what this guy's all about, MVPs and experiments and whatever. Let's test it out. And I get to pick the project, CEO's prerogative. So I pick the Series X diesel reciprocating platform. And if the software guy can work on that, then maybe we'll listen to him a little more. So I was like, okay, yes, sir, you got it. And so we did this. We chose this project, and we literally did it in their legendary Crotonville facility, if you've ever been. It's a remarkable place. And now I want you to picture the scene for this workshop. There's me. There's three people from the Series X team who've been summoned up from Texas to sit in this workshop with me. And then there are 25 corporate vice presidents just sitting in the back of the room just to observe. So it was a terrific setup for a workshop, let me tell you. And the poor, I felt so bad for the team who had been summoned from Texas for this. And I was like, okay, if we're going to do the workshop under these circumstances, let's start with what is the Series X engine? Like, someone teach me the currently approved business plan. So we had them put up the slides on the board, and they started to explain to everybody what is it, what it's used for, the different use cases, why it's going to be worth so much money. And you know, and I really didn't know anything about what this product was, and I had to be educated about it. But then they put up a slide that I will never forget as long as I live. It was the revenue forecast by year for the Series X engine for the next, I want to say, 30 years. I want you to visualize this bar chart. First five bars, blank, because we're going to spend our 5 years in stealth R&D with no customers, obviously. Then the bars have a very distinctive shape you may be familiar with here in Silicon Valley called the hockey stick. So it starts out at like $100 million a year, and it's like chugging along, and then pretty soon, these bars get really tall, and it's like we're going to make, I don't know, billions of dollars a year of revenue. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't know anything about diesel engines, but like, I know this chart. Step into my office, my friends. I have made this chart many times. Silicon Valley is maybe our third leading export after, you know, buzzwords and hype is the chart. So, okay, let's talk. And I was like, okay, just for my edification, please everyone raise your hand if you believe this forecast. And I'm not making this up. Every single person in the room but me, raise your hand. And they were a little bit miffed by the question, like, listen, kid, you must not understand. The brightest minds of the GE Corporation have vetted this plan. This is the basis upon which we are going to invest $300 million. You must not. I was like, I'm so sorry. My mistake. No offense intended, but no, really. And I picked a bar at random. Who here actually believes that in the year, you know, 2025, you're going to have exactly 1.63, a lot of significant digits on these charts, $1.6357 billion in revenue exactly? And all the hands are like, oh, well, put it down. Well, you know, it's like, okay, so can we have an honest conversation about what do we know and what's the hypothesis? What are our assumptions? And one of my favorite assumptions, this is GE, so like it's an engineering, finance-driven company, so the material science challenges of this engine, because it had to work. I'm thinking this thing has to work on a train, on a boat, in a plane, everything. It has to do so many things. We've made the problem for the engineers extremely difficult by increasing, ratcheting up the technical degree of difficulty. That's why you have to basically win a Nobel Prize in order to build the materials necessary to do this thing. And so I started to ask, like, after I get the Nobel Prize, after we build the thing, how do customers get it? And they're like, oh, well, if you look in business plan appendix B, you know, asterisk sub bullet 2, we're going to build a brand new worldwide distribution network and service and support network to go up against an entrenched competitor. And I'm like, so have we done that before? We know how to do that? And they're like, well, it's a new segment for us, so no. So maybe we want to think about finding out if there's like a customer issue sooner than the 5 years. So we're starting to have the conversation about what would it take to build a minimum viable product. How can we start the learning process a little bit early? And at first they're like, kid, nobody wants a minimum viable engine. This thing is gonna explode if you cut more, you know, like software guy like does not understand anything. And I was like, okay, my bad, you know, but is there one of the use cases that's easier than the other four? You know, so can we do that one? Oh, well, stationary drilling is a lot easier than fracking because it don't have to move, so the weight's not a concern. I go, great, so what if we just did that? But then, of course, when the VPs is like, but hold on, if we only do one use case, our business plan is cut, you know, 80% smaller and we're not going to make any money. I'm like, but we've just made the fantasy plan smaller. We haven't changed real life. Nothing's happened yet, so can we keep going? Okay. And I was like, okay, so one, and so what would it take? How long does it take to do just one engine? And again, they were like, kid, you obviously don't understand manufacturing. Once you set up the supply chain and the assembly line and the facility, the whole point is it's the same amount of time whether you make one or 10,000 of the thing. This is mass production. I was like, my apologies again. No offense intended. Not one line of engines. One engine. Can you make me one individual one? And of course, one of the engineers is like, oh, sure. Well, the first year we have to create a unit for certification, safety, da-da-da-da-da. So I was like, oh, so I could sell that engine to somebody? And they're like, oh, okay. I mean, no, of course you couldn't, but I guess not technically you could. And it's like, all right. And then the engineers started to get the hang of it. And they're like, oh, I got it. So, and one of the engineers, I never forget this, was like, hey, you know, guys, if we're just making one engine and it's just for this one use case, we could just take one of our existing engines and modify it and get pretty much the same technical performance, not the weight characteristics, but we pick the weight-free use case. And we could do that in like 90 days or 6 months. And I was like, this is Brent. I was like, any VPs in here have a customer that might want to buy this engine? And one of the sales VPs is like, hell yeah. I got a customer who every quarter is constantly in my office asking me for this exact same thing. Like, I can make this. And I was like, we are cooking with grease now. So we're going to take this cycle time to market from 5 years to 6 months, a full order of magnitude improvement in the over the course of 4 hours, and I'm going to be a genius. This is gonna be. And one of the VPs who was just not having a good time is finally like, I'm sorry, I can't take it anymore. Excuse me. What is the point of selling only one engine? See it from this guy's point of view. We were about to make $4 billion, and now I'm going to have him actually lose money on this one sale because the engine is too expensive, and so it's going to go from plus $4 billion to like minus whatever, 10,000. He's like, what is the point? Why are we doing this? And I was like, look, you're right. If you already know what's going to happen in the future, and you're right about this plan, then what I'm suggesting, these experiments, are a waste of time because you don't need to learn anything. And he was like, great. I'm out of here. Like, he was like, terrific. And that was the moment when his colleagues in the room were like, hold on, time out. Didn't we just say a second ago that we don't know what's going to happen in the future and we have these uncertainties? And they themselves started to build this program, not me as the outsider. They started to say, hey, what could we do? And several of the skeptics in that, you know, even from that very first workshop, came around and said, wait a minute, this could be really powerful. And they kind of saw it in action. And that was the start of a program that we eventually called FastWorks. We started with one project, and then four projects, and then eight projects at a time, and then we started to scale it up. And because it's GE, they make everything. So I mean, the first round of projects, we did Series X engine, we did an actual combined cycle power plant natural gas turbine, we did a refrigerator, we did a neonatal incubator. In the next round, we did MRI and an ultrasound. It was just like, they just kept coming. It was like Muppet Labs over there. And then we started to do non-products. We did IT systems, HR systems. We did a corporate integration when they buy startups, a checklist. I mean, it's just like, it started to really, I was about to say metastasize. That's not quite the metaphor I'm going for. It started to really spread in this exponential way. And we wound up training every CEO of every one of their businesses, all of their direct reports, and everybody at the next executive level down, what GE calls the executive band and above. That's more than 5,000 managers globally in what we call fast workspace, lean startup applied at GE. So it was a remarkable experience over the course of 2 or 3 years where we really made a very dramatic change in the way the company worked. And if you look at, by the end, and in the book I try to show the different phases of the transformation and analogize them to the pieces of a startup S-curve or even to the incredible work that Todd did through healthcare.gov and building USDS, that in all these transformations, you wind up accomplishing things at the end that seemed absolutely impossible at the beginning. So at GE, they're like these sacred cows, the employee management system, that they changed the company value.
That's the thing that blew my mind, right?
Right.
When I got to that part of the book, right? I mean, GE is like legendary for how they evaluate people super rigorously, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's a
Jack
Welch special.
And they changed that. Yeah. So can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So EMS, this is like a famous, if you study HR in corporations, I mean, GE is famous for having invented the employee management system. And the current trend for KPI, individual KPIs for employees is like just a rehash of that same breakthrough idea a while ago, which is that every person in the company should have a specific functional target of what they're supposed to accomplish that is quantitative, and then we evaluate them every year based on that. Now, I never heard of EMS. I'm not an HR junkie, so I never heard of it. And one of the early projects, I tell a story in the book, we were working on a turbine, and the plan was to spend, I think, $80 million, $100 million, something like that, to build this product over 3 or 4 years, launch it worldwide. It's going to be used in the developing world, so a really different product than the Series X. And the team was really frustrated with how long it was taking them to get it to market, and we were debating different ways to get it to market faster. One of the concepts we talked about in the room was, for the engineering geeks out there, called set-based concurrent engineering, called SBCE. An old Toyota lean manufacturing technique to do components in parallel rather than in series. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, it doesn't matter. And we're getting real excited because doing things in parallel means you can get to market much faster. We did that same exercise. Hey, we aren't doing a line of edge of the home in the first time. We got the cycle time down from, you know, more than 3 years to less than 18 months. And we're really excited in the workshop. And this is, of course, we do these three-day workshops for Fastworks. And we're getting towards the climax of it. I'm like, hey, this is going great. So we're going to do this plan now. And they're like, oh, definitely not. I was like, oh, I'm sorry, Thomas, did I misunderstand? Is it not a better plan than the previous plan? They're like, oh, it's much better. So we're going to do it. And they're like, oh, definitely not going to do it. No way we're doing it. I was like, but isn't it a lot less expensive than the previous plan? Doesn't it have a higher probability of success? Yeah, like I'm a GE shareholder. It's better for the shareholders. Like, But we're not going to do it. And they're like, no, because of EMS. And I was like, okay, I don't understand. They're like, well, if we do it in parallel, if we do this new thing, there's going to be a lot more rework. And that's going to cost extra money. We can't afford to do that. I was like, and it's engineers. You're like, well, how much extra money? Like, this is going to cost an extra $1 million to develop. But isn't this an $80 million program? So isn't it going to save us $79 million to do the? And they're like, oh, for sure. Yes, absolutely. So we're going to do it. Oh, no, EMS. And finally, I was just like, who is EMS? Who do I call? What is EMS? And then finally, one of the engineers like took pity on me and took me aside. I was like, listen, EMS is like carved in the stone tablets around here. You can't, this is how it works. And every engineer has an individual metric about how much rework they personally cause every year. So if you do this new thing, sure, it's better for the company, but it's going to be worse for their promotion prospects. It's going to be a big problem for them with their managers. It's a concept I call in the book career equity. The true way that people are rewarded in any organization is their perception of future career advancement opportunities. That's much bigger than any, in most organizations, once you're past the founder and the early employees, it's bigger than any financial equity they could possibly have, and it's much bigger in a traditional organization than their salary and bonus. Right, this is like, what kind of budget are you going to control one day when you work your way up the ladder and you become the VP or the head of product or whatever you aspire to do in your career? And that's true in government and nonprofit, it doesn't matter. Whatever you perceive to be in advance. So they were like, look, I can't, my career would be destroyed by doing this thing that's better for the company. I was like, well, who do I talk to about EMS? I'll get it fixed. I was very arrogant at that time. I was like, well, I got all these fancy executives, they like me. I'll just go tell them to make an exception. And they're like, you cannot make an exception. It's like, I was like, who do I talk to about gravity? Is there someone I can just be, can we suspend grab for a minute? Because it's like, you know, and they're like, that's kid, that is not how. Or so when I started talking to G people that we're going to change EMS, change the corporate value, and the people were like, that can never happen. And it was like, at the end of 3 years, it was dramatically different. It was astonishing how quickly, once you get the political and corporate momentum necessary to make these changes, and you have to do it carefully and in a certain sequence, you can't mess around with this. They did, and they got rid of, not just they got rid of the like top-down way that they did EMS, they added a series of lean startup-related criteria to the program, and I'm just now realizing what I can and can't say, so I got to be a little careful. But so I don't think they've released publicly the specific details of what they put in the new values. I think the top-level summary is in the book, so you have to consult that so I don't get ahead of myself. But they made some changes that absolutely seemed impossible at the beginning. And I remember talking even to the executives about making those changes at the start, and they said, oh, we'll never be able. That's just totally nuts. And we did that for every function in the whole company. We did we did that in legal, in compliance, in HR. We did it in finance. We changed how they do budgeting and finance for projects using a system of metered funding we call growth boards. I mean, it was very, as you say, they really went all in with it. And I think it's a hallmark of a well-run company that this kind of transformation is something they know how to do. So once, like, it took a long time to convince them it was the right thing to do and get them on board with the experiment, but once they decided to commit, they didn't mess around.
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
They're a great example of what you talk about in the book around companies needing an entrepreneurship function.
That's right.
So you can talk a bit about that, like what that
means. Oh, sure.
What the role of that function is.
Yeah, so going back to the org chart complaint that I had, that we're using the same org chart since Alfred Sloan. I always ask CEOs, who's in charge of commercializing new products in this company? Who's in charge of innovation? Who's in charge of taking existing products into new markets? Whose job is that? I usually get one of two answers. Sometimes I'll get like, well, it's somebody, like it's the head of engineering's second job. I'm like, well, but being the head of engineering is kind of a full-time job. So it's like, it's what, his hobby on the side? She can do it like in her spare time? Like, and they'd be like, well, but it, you know. Or they'll be like, well, innovation is everybody's job. Can you imagine if we tolerated that for other functions? We don't need a head of marketing. Marketing is everybody's job. We don't need a CFO. Finance is everybody's job. What are we talking about? Like, it's not anybody's job. If it's everybody's job, then it's nobody's job. And then if it's not somebody's job, we can't get good at it. We can't create ladders of advancement for people who are good at it. We can't define what like best practices look like for us as an organization in innovation. We can't we can't cross-train across the different aspects of innovation that happen in an organization. So to me, I call it the missing function in the corporate org chart. We just have we just missed something that, to be fair, when Alfred Sloan put it together, it wasn't that important, and it's become increasingly important in the modern economy. So let's just get serious about it. Let's call it by its proper name. Let's just call it entrepreneurship. Let's create business cards that say what they need to say about that's what you do. Because in most organizations, if you talk to a product manager, you'll have two people sit side by side. One product manager is building version 9,200 of the thing we've been making for 125 years. Like, GE still makes light bulbs, okay? Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, and they're still making it. And some of those light bulbs, you know, like they're a lot better than the ones Thomas Edison made, but like at a certain level, it's really version 9,000 of the same thing. And then every once in a while, you're like, I want to make a Series X engine. And it's like, what the bleep is that, right? So the level of uncertainty in those two situations is dramatically different than two people have the same business card. Guess whose corporate review looks better in EMS? There's like the one person who does like very high reliability things. They just always, they call their shot. In business, we call it having a high say-do ratio. When they say we're going to sell this many more light bulbs than last quarter, it's like they make it happen. And you have this other guy who like routinely misses their accountability targets by like three orders of magnitude. And it's like, but I learned so much. I should get more funding. And like, you know, you can't put learning in the annual report. You can't return learning to your limited partners. Like, you can't pay a dividend to Wall Street in learning. Like, who cares about learning? Where's the money? Right? So it's not fair to people's career equity to give them projects that have this high uncertainty attached to them, which is why in most organizations, people who truly are entrepreneurial are much more likely to get fired than promoted. And then managers are always like, well, why don't we innovate around here? It's like, because you pay people not to. You actively prevent it. You fire anyone who dares to do it. So actually, the fact that we're so consistent in our ability to not innovate is a remarkable achievement. Getting a large group of human beings to do anything consistently at all is very difficult, you may have noticed. So you see 10,000 or just 300,000 people all doing something very consistent, that's not random chance. And that's not selection bias. We happen to find only 300,000 uncreative people. Like, human beings are innately creative. You can't stamp it out of them. It's really annoying. So if we are creating in our company a creativity dampening field that prevents this from happening, that seems depressing. You're like, gosh, that's a lot of work to make sure that we never grow or, you know, serve customers well. But I choose to see that in a very positive light, which is that this is not some mysterious force. You could turn the machine off. And we could create a different system, not for every employee, for every product, but like for projects that truly have high uncertainty and that require an entrepreneurial situation. We call it the startup as an atomic unit of work. And we say that's a tool in our toolkit. Just like Amazon has the famous two pizza team, right? The team no larger that you can feed with two pizzas. There's certain projects like, hey, I have an idea. Let's create Amazon Web Services. And you're like, but we're a bookstore. It's like, I know, but let me just try it. Like, let's throw a two pizza team at that. Let's not bet the whole company on it before we have any idea if it's a good idea, but neither should we like strategize and debate about it for a year while we decide whether or not to do it. Let's just go run the experiment, and let's see that as the proper functioning of a corporation to do that in a reliable and repeatable way.
And I just found this just incredibly impressive in terms of what you and GE were doing. I mean, not just to take a set of projects and run them differently, yeah. Right? But to reconfigure personnel, finance, legal, et cetera, yeah. So that anyone across the company, right, ultimately, who has an entrepreneurial idea, has a path to follow, which is remarkable. And I think is a defining feature of what you call the modern company, right, versus the old-fashioned company. What other features of the modern company do you think are particularly important to emphasize in terms of the paradigm that
So there's a paradox to this, which is that in order to do rapid experimentation in the short term, you have to have a philosophy of long-term thinking to make it work. And it's totally counterintuitive because if you look at most companies that are run quarter to quarter, they only have two kinds of projects. They have projects that can be whose results can be realized in the current or next quarter, and then other. in the current or next quarter bucket, there's very strong accountability and very strong process and procedure. And then in other, there's nothing. There's just, it's other. We don't know what to do with that. So the smart strategy, if you're a competent and savvy political manager, is to make sure that you have a project that's considered high priority but in other. Plus up the scope as much as possible so that you can delay accountability as long as possible. And I've seen, you know, you see these like zombie IT projects that go on for years. I mean, we're talking about five, and the federal government got tons of these projects that just go on and on and on and on. And a really savvy manager realizes you can get promoted before the project ships. And then whatever happens is the next idiot's problem. Not in your company, I understand. I see some people in the audience. I don't, but in a friend's company, you've heard of this happening? We don't talk about that. We pretend like this doesn't happen. But like, so to me, that is like, we got to stop that. It's just an insane black hole waste of resources. And, you know, we got to be able to sustain our commitment over generations, but then not be so overconfident that we know everything, that we can do these big programs. So we use experiments to discover which things are the right things to do. The test for me is always, if I went back to my dungeon, you know, my D&D set, and I pulled out my 300,000-sided die, and I rolled it, and I picked a random employee of the corporation, truly at random, and I said to them, I recount this conversation I had with Jeff Immelt in the book, I said, if I picked an employee at random, and I said, let's say you had the next big disruptive idea for this company, how would you get it implemented? How would you test to find out if you were right? What's the procedure? And the only answer in most organizations is like, well, I guess I would ask my manager to ask her manager, to ask his peer-wise functional peer in the other function, to ask his manager, to ask his subordinate. And like by the time they've sketched this out, they're like, forget it. I'm obviously not going to do that. It's so much work. And for what, right? Like all the grief you're going to get for going over all these managers. That's like, I'm just going to do my job. Leave me alone. And so that's unacceptable to me. We talk about the importance of companies being a meritocracy and good ideas can come from anywhere. And I call BS on that idea. If we're not serious about saying what's the procedure by which we harness all these good ideas and say that no matter what your business card says, no matter where in the organization you live, no matter what you look like, and no matter what your background is, you have an opportunity to put your ideas to the test. And also, we deal with the curse of this, which is that most ideas are terrible. Right? Most startups are going to fail. So we can't just invest the whole company in everything. We got to have a system for experimentation that's available to every employee. And you saw this at Intuit when they did Design for Delight. You saw this at Fastworks with something they call Fastworks Every Day. You saw some analogs to this just starting towards the tail end of the last administration in USDS and 18F, where you start to then realize, you know, this is not just a training and an opportunity just for fancy special projects. Everyone has the opportunity to think of themselves like an entrepreneur and try things because we fundamentally don't know which ideas are going to work. So if you only train the entrepreneurs, you're by definition missing out on a huge segment of people who you didn't know they were entrepreneurs till they had the good idea. And I think that's, to me, the essence of a modern company. We see employees as a resource to be invested in, not a liability to be reduced. We see every human being as a source of incredible creative potential. And we use the scientific method to figure out which ideas are actually good and bad. And that's like, and if somebody, you know, I kind of talk at the end of the book, like they offer to employees a bill of rights. If you have a good idea and you can contribute to it productively, then you can get equity in its outcome and you can stay in a leadership role with it as it scales, as long as you're doing that in a productive way. And that just, to me, that's a far more humane, much more productive, and just a frankly more fun kind of workplace to be in, right? Thank you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Right? We're going to start taking questions in about 2 minutes. So if you have questions, or if you don't have them, start formulating them and start looking for the microphone at the back of the room there, and we'll start the live audience Q&A shortly. I'll ask maybe a final question before we actually start that. So you're at work on a new venture now.
Yes.
Which I understand for regulatory reasons you can't talk too much about, but the long-term stock exchange.
Yeah.
Which I can say this, maybe you can't, right? It holds great promise to creating the right kind of magnetic field, right, for companies to begin to pursue this kind of structure and orientation, right? So can you talk a bit more about LTSE and your motivation for starting it and whatever you can say about
it? Obviously, could be a little careful what I say, but you're used to that. Yeah, so this is an idea that I floated in the very last pages of the Lean Startup, actually, all the way back in 2011, that somebody really should build a new kind of stock exchange that would simultaneously regulate the behavior of managers and investors to bring back an older idea of kind of long-term alignment in our capital markets. And I wrote it as a suggestion because at the time I was really struggling with the fact that I was studying the Toyota production system and Jeff Bezos and saying, hey, everybody, if you want to follow Lean Startup, you should create the next Toyota. You should create the next Amazon. And at the same time, at the time, I was mostly working with venture-backed companies in Silicon Valley and similar startup hubs whose aspiration in life is to do what we call an exit, to sell the product or company to a public company or to become a public company ourselves. And we all know that what actually exits, in a lot of cases, is the innovation itself. And the product winds up being sunsetted. And like, when was the last time you heard that one of your favorite products was being acquired by a big company? And you're like, awesome. No, we all know that like most of the time, that's a terrible outcome. So I was feeling this kind of guilt almost that we are building an ecosystem where we're, you know, we create these incredible things and then we plant them in this hostile soil of short-termism and it's terrible. Plus, because of Lean Startup, I got this incredible backstage pass to world business. Like I got to go meet companies of every size. I've worked with companies at every order of magnitude from two founders in a garage, you know, 20, 200, 2,000, 20,000, 200,000 and these big massive bureaucracies. Like I've seen it, you know, and like, this problem of short-termism is on everybody's lips, and we treat it like it's this thing that's happening to us, like a law of nature. Just that's how it is. And I don't know. I don't find that acceptable. I don't think we should treat it like a law of nature. These are human systems that we ourselves designed, in a lot of cases, misdesigned. So I said somebody really should build a long-term stock exchange. I kind of sketched out how it should work, and I was like, my work here is done. I'm an author. I put the idea out there, and somebody will run with it. And if you look at that chapter of Lean Startup, almost every idea I suggested that somebody should really do something about, people really have taken seriously. I was saying some ideas about how we should change how we teach education, teach entrepreneurship in educational settings. And you look at like the work Tom Eisenman has done at HBS. Lean Startup is now part of the core curriculum for every MBA student. You see what Steve Blank has done at Stanford and with the iCore program at NSF. And so like a lot of the ideas that were in there, and these are not necessarily my original ideas, but like people have done those things. Except for one. Nobody ever called me up to be like, I want to do the stock exchange. How do I get started with that? It's just, it was too crazy for people, I guess. And so it's just one of those ideas that wouldn't leave me alone. And I was like, well, I should at least learn enough about this idea to find out why it's a bad idea, and then it will leave me alone. And so over the course of the last 5 years, I spent time kind of studying it, learning about it, and just trying to see how capital markets work. And the more that I studied it and talked to people about it, the more I decided that it might be crazy, but it's not a bad idea. There's no reason it can't happen. Stock exchanges are not like carved on the stone tablets by Moses. They're created by congressional statute and SEC authorization. Like, you know, these are human procedures to do this. And so I was lucky enough to be able to recruit a team of pretty incredible folks and investors to give us a shot. So stay tuned. We're in the regulatory process, but we should have progress to share soon.
Fantastic. Okay, we've got a bunch of folks lined up for questions.
Oh, good. Hey.
So just as a reminder of Marissa's guidance at the beginning, please ask an actual question, 15 words with a question mark at the end. So,
hi, Eric. Thank you for speaking, first of all.
Thank you.
My question for you is, what advice would you give to young entrepreneurs or just entrepreneurs in general that are currently in the middle of the startup phase? So the entity's formed, they have the disruptive idea. They have a product out in the market, but they haven't scaled yet. What advice would you give them?
I'm really sorry, man. Entrepreneurs never ask hypothetical questions. I love this. It's like, yeah, they have this situation that they're in. I got your buddy's startup. I hear you. It's really simple, okay? So of course, the most important advice to be an entrepreneur is just to get started. You have to actually start. And Tom may have been the one who taught me this little heuristic I always remember, right? Think big, start small, scale fast. So I always go back to that. So you're set, you're in motion, that's good. And feel free to come see me after if you have like a little more detail you want to fill in on what the challenge is. But I would say the number one most important thing is to realize that everything you do in a startup, whether you admit it or not, is an experiment. Like, so I sometimes get into debates with entrepreneurs. Should I do it like an experiment or should I do something else? And it's like, there's no something else. It's an experiment, whatever you say. Now, is it a good experiment? Is it well designed? Well, what makes a good experiment? A good experiment, we would say, is the most efficient way to learn what you want to learn. So a lot of people get into entrepreneurship and they hear move fast and break things or fail fast or whatever, like kind of my view is not quite what Lean Startup is trying to say. And they interpret that to mean I better ship something quickly and see what happens. And the problem with that is you are guaranteed to succeed at seeing what happens. Something will definitely happen. And the human psychology is such that you will retroactively decide that that's success. And I tell some funny stories of people making that mistake in the book. So you got to say, like, what do I really want to learn? How quickly can I learn it? And then just write it down. A 3x5 index card is fine. Write down what you thought was going to happen, because the human mind is such that once it happens, you will retroactively remember having known it was going to turn out that way all along. That's like, you know, that's why being a pundit is a great job. Just like, that's exactly what I predicted was going to happen, and that's just, that's how we all operate. So you got to fight back against that tendency. So yeah, think like a scientist, like really design a good experiment, figure out what you want to learn. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you for an amazing conversation tonight.
Oh, thank you.
What I'm wondering is, can the same type of disruption that you brought to GE and the same level of disruption that you brought to GE be brought to the public sector, like government? I think in that scenario, usually an MVP is not about product, but it can be about policy. And I guess this question's for both of you.
I mean, you got the world's expert on this subject sitting right next to me.
It absolutely can. And there's a lot about that in the book as well. I think that the stage that we're at as a government, I'm no longer there, but there are many compatriots that continue to work at this in government, and new compatriots have joined. It is one stage shy of where GE is. I think where the U.S. government is that a growing number of projects are being executed in lean startup style with incredible results. A growing number of apparatuses like the U.S. Digital Service, ATF, which you can read about in the book, have been constructed to help facilitate that. Right, and it's spreading, spreading, spreading. Where the U.S. government is not yet is it hasn't yet really reconfigured finance, legal,
procurement. Procurement is the big one for
and it's beginning to do that, right? But really what's happened to date is that these projects have gotten exceptions to the standard. But the standards themselves haven't yet really evolved. And that's why it was so inspiring to read about that at GE.
Yeah.
Because it shows it is, can be, it is can possible be. In a very large, complicated human organization. So I'm going to... make sure everyone I know
please
in the U.S. government like reads about GE.
Yeah, well, call me up. And I can't tell you how many times, you know, one of the weird things about this, because I got to work both in the private and public sectors often sometimes at the same time, it's like I would be with a private sector company who would be complaining about some government agency, and they're like, oh, the FDA won't let us innovate because, you know, they're so slow. And I'd be like, I'm actually also doing a project with the FDA right now, and they tell me that they can't, that you guys are too slow, and you never file anything until you've, like, you know, exhausted every alternative or whatever. And like, so, like, you would see all these excuses, like, they don't want to do it, we don't want to do it. I was like, guys, can we come together and collaborate to get to a common outcome here? And what are the barriers that make that happen? There's all these systems that get in the way. I'll just make one shout out to a pretty, what I consider to be a very crazy story that I managed to get into the book. There's a project at the NSA for the system they use to literally print out, generate and print out the nuclear codes. Okay, like I want you to think about that the nuclear codes have to be changed multiple times a day. Somebody has to print them out and put them in the suitcase. Like, it's a very solemn responsibility, can you imagine? And there's this innovation team that, you know, using Lean Startup techniques had changed the way that they do the codes in such a way that was like much more humane to the people who were involved in the project. And it's like, in the grand scheme of things, this is not like, it's a project is, you know, not, it's not the next Facebook or whatever, but it's important. It's the nuclear codes, right? And, you know, and anyway, you can read the story in the book. It's just like one of a ton of defense and national security projects that we've done through the educational arm of Lean Startup, the Lean Startup company that we do these kind of trainings and support.
Bless you.
But what's really interesting about it is just doing that project as a one-off is not that big a deal. But then you start to say, well, why is it so hard to do those kind of projects? They're like, well, can you imagine the supply chain issues they have at the NSA? Like before, you can just like you can't just go buy a USB cable off the street because who knows who was there before putting God knows what in the USB cable, right? So like the certification of the spot's like insanely complicated. And so if you want people to be able to innovate using off-the-shelf components, you have to build a system to support that kind of innovation over and over again. So it's like the start of leveling up the conversation from individual projects that operate by exception to building the systems that support entrepreneurial thinking in a consistent way. And I'm like, if they could do it at the NSA, your organization is not in a more challenging environment. It's just not. So yeah, I like that story a lot.
Carlo, 7-time entrepreneur, couple exits. Thanks, Eric.
Congratulations.
Question for both of you. Without going into too much detail, can you name the best and worst startup that's implemented the startup way?
Well, I mean, once you implement that startup can't way, be the startup way, you can't be the worst because I'm trying to get people to read this book, man. I'm actually I really am not a believer in naming names of companies positively or negatively. I don't like to talk crap about companies that have done it badly. I've been in tons of companies that have asked me to come in and taking a look at what would be required to do this and are like, thanks for coming in. No, thank you. And of course, there's a number of companies that are doing it well. I've been very lucky to be able to tell some of those stories in the book, but the vast majority of companies don't want to talk on the record about this, and I always respect their privacy. We put on a conference every year, Lean Startup Conference. It's coming up next week in San Francisco. You're all invited as my friends. Come on by. We let companies speak for themselves about what they're doing, and then people can judge for themselves, is that really a lean startup? Because this is not a religion. You cannot be excommunicated from it, and you cannot be blessed to do it. Like, and people are always like, I'm not your guru. Okay, this is not a spiritual quest. I'm of the Peter Drucker school. He said, people call me guru because they can't spell charlatan. Okay, I'm not your, like, that's not what this is. So you have to judge for yourself which companies are really relevant for you. And here's the catch. Whatever companies I name, I've done this exercise before, it's a trap. If people are resistant to it, they'll be like, well, that company doesn't count because it's not really so similar to mine. And I get this a lot. You know, now I've developed a pretty big library of case studies. So usually if like someone's in manufacturing, I can show them a manufacturing example, retail example, healthcare, a healthcare example. You know, I've built up the library. I was once with a company that was doing consumer packaged goods. And I was like, okay, how about retail store? And like, well, we're not a store. Like, okay, but how about like an appliance company that sells at a store? Like, well, we don't make appliance. How about like a healthcare products? And they're like, no, that's not really right. And we got down to like another product that was also sold in grocery stores. And like, well, that's a different aisle of the store. It's not really the same over there. And I was like, okay, forget it, right? Like, what's the question behind the question? Of like, why do we really want to know this? And I just feel like the temptation as a business author, I read a lot of business books, like, is to just kind of posthumously adopt all these companies, like all the great companies that you admire of the moment, those are the ones that do my thing, you know? And so it's always the same, it's always like Apple and Southwest and whoever, like it's always the same companies that do everybody's theory, and you're like, it can't possibly be right. So don't take it on faith, don't look for a guru to tell you, like go see the example, like go hear what companies say for themselves and evaluate yourself, and then more important than any of that, test the idea yourself. Like, if this is a scientific theory, it's kind of ridiculous to say you should take it on faith. Like, go run an experiment tomorrow, on Monday. You know, go, like, don't think about it for months and months, but go think of it as, like, this is a specific theory. I tried to make the book as specific as I possibly could so that you can really see the theory makes predictions about what's supposed to happen if you do certain things. So go see if those things really happen, and if they don't happen, if you find some context that this doesn't work or this prompts you to learn something better, like, I want to read your book about it. So come back and teach the rest of us the better way.
These are two themes I really loved in the book, that you ferociously resisted the urge to say, here's the magic formula.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But say everyone's a snowflake, right?
Yeah.
Here are just things to keep in mind. And objectives you should have, right?
Yeah, thank you for that.
And the second theme I loved was that actually implementing the startup way in the way that's right for your organization is in and of itself a lean startup.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't do a giant top-down waterfall kapow right on the heads of everyone in the organization. You do an MVP. and I thought that was incredibly wise.
I call it in the book, just to give it a little taste of grandiosity, the unified theory of entrepreneurship. That today there are 9 different kinds of work that are organized in 9 different places on the org chart that we pretend are 9 different things that are actually the same thing happening over and over again. And the way I can, you know, I can prove it to you easily, if you've ever been in the room where when a company buys a startup, corp dev has to eventually have a meeting with product development where they hand over the asset for now maintenance. It's like, we've just bought this thing for $800 million and you have to now operate it forever to create all this growth and productivity savings and whatever, whatever, like best of luck. And product development's like, what did you buy? The what? You want us to do the what? To who? What? This isn't worth $800 million. And like, we pretend like those are two totally different things. I was just with another company today that does the thing where they find, like, they let somebody leave the company, they start a company, and then you buy the startup back. And we celebrate that as a corp dev win instead of a colossal HR failure. So, like, let's just admit, creating a brand new product from scratch, if you can't create a brand new product from scratch because your soil is inhospitable to new things, then when you buy a startup and transplant it into the soil, it's not going to work. When you take a new product into an existing product into a new market, you're going to have the same problem. Corp dev, venturing, you know, partnerships and licensing. But also, you're building a new IT system from scratch. Like, that's a waterfall project. Like, there's no uncertainty there. Like, if I was starting an IT startup to sell you the software, you'd be like, that's very risky. But, oh, well, the people work here? Oh, then they have to use it. We'll just tell them what to do. It'll be fine. It's not risky at all. Like, that's ridiculous. So, of course, new IT project, new HR project. Anyway, eventually you say, but what about this corporate transformation? Huh. It has to start small. If it works, it will have this incredible disruptive impact across thousands or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of employees. It could have incredible productivity benefits for the company, or it could fizzle out and totally not work. And you're like, doesn't that sound a little familiar? So, like, you know, at the end of the book, I try to make the case we should see corporate transformation as something that should be managed centrally under the auspices of the entrepreneurship function, along with those 8 other things. And then if you're going to go through all the pain of developing the corporate capability to transform, you only want to do it once. Like, seriously, this is the last business book. I can call my publisher right now and, like, hang it up. It's all done. We have found the one true management system for all time. It's all over. Like, come on. Can we be real about this for a second? The 21st century, like, as crazy as it seems so far, we ain't seen nothing yet. Right? What we have experienced is the slowest pace of change we will ever experience in our lifetimes. We'll look back on this as the comfortable, simple, easy days. Okay? We're not going to need new organizational forums to deal with that. Like, oh, yes, we are. So why don't we treat the people who do corporate transformations as entrepreneurs, see them as a resource to be maintained in the company, and then plant the seeds to do it again and again and again and again, call it continuous transformation. I think it's what organizations are going to need in the 21st century. Governments, civic institutions, big companies, you name it. That's what we have to do. Oh, thank you.
This is going to be our last audience question.
So this question goes out to both of you. What is your greatest success? What is your greatest successful thought that you have executed, like, and gone out, gone through? And what is your least successful thought that you have actually gone through with? And what did you learn from both of those?
Go ahead.
It's gonna be pretty long.
I don't want to get metaphysical on you, but, like, what constitutes a successful thought? See, that's the engineer in me. It's like we have to define terms and get proper syntax, because, look, I've built companies that have been very successful, and I've built some companies that not so much. And I have the failure ones. I have too many to choose from. You know, so many stories to choose from. So. But just stepping back kind of like to the bigger picture for a second, I think business success and impact, while important, is not the end all be all. And I think, you know, we've especially gotten the lesson lately that this is a social issue, not just a business issue, like about what kind of society we want to have and how do we want people, as a kind of matter of like personal development, to have the idea, like to have the permission to try out bad ideas and see what happens and learn from it. Because I've learned the most by far from the colossal screw-ups, and the more screwed up, the better. In terms of what you learn, and you can say, and right, at the time, of course, it's horrible, but that's what's so so key. So I would say for us to embrace a society that can have more nonconformist thought and give people more permission to fail and try new things, like that, that would be a successful thought, I guess. Anyway, so yeah, sorry for a non-answer, but that's the best I can do.
Fantastic. I'm getting the signal, actually, that we need to wrap up. And there's an informed tradition to ask all of our speakers the following question, which is, what is your 60-second idea to change the world? Clock starts now.
So I feel like we are relearning a bunch of lessons that our grandparents had to learn the hard way, and then we have basically, like, they built us this beautiful house that we have been living in, and we basically, like, periodically say, hey, let's chop up some of the foundations for firewood, and then the house doesn't fall down, so we're like, I guess that's fine, and we're, like, hacking away at the civic institutions that they built for us, like, blithely, and then we're surprised that we're having, like, a repeat of experiences that they had, and we don't understand why, so... I really hope that this next era will spawn a rebirth in the creation of civic institutions that will get us back to the kind of very simple and elementary truths about what a fair and sustainable society we ought to have is that our grandparents had to learn. I hope the way we learn that lesson is a lot less painful than the way our grandparents had to learn it.
Please join me in thanking Eric Reese.
Thank you. Thank you.